You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 12th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Alex Marshall and the surprising design of market economies. Also on the program today, it's reported that President Obama plans to expand the number of Americans eligible for overtime pay. Meanwhile, in Florida, special election, Democratic candidate loses, and the lesson is not much. New study shows just how much more access you get if you say you're a donor than a constituent, at least with Democratic members of Congress. Chris Christie's numbers continue to sink under the weight of his scandals. We're looking at maybe a constitutional crisis over this CIA spying on the Senate. And in Guantanamo Bay, finally, the force feeding of prisoners will get a hearing in civilian courts. And the right wing, I guess, outrage machine just shocked at the notion that a president would be involved in an online video show. Promote healthcare.gov. Huge. It's disgusting. I can't even say the words. David Gergen makes an ass out of himself about it. All that and more on today's program. Just a programming note. We will be talking to Mike Mazzetti tomorrow regarding the what's going on with the CIA and the Senate Intelligence Committee and the report on the CIA torture regime of the Bush years. And this thing is heating up, and we will talk at length about it tomorrow. Did I say Mark Mazzetti, or did I say I said Mike? It's Mark Mazzetti. Sorry about that. We will get into all of that tomorrow, but I still am just stunned at the outrage about Obama appearing with Zach Galifianakis. We talked about this in the funner half of the program yesterday. But the outrage, the indignation, right-wingers losing their mind, and David Gergen, the esteemed former, I think, Nixon advisor, am I right? Oh, he advised for Clinton.
Nixon, Reagan, Clinton.
And now I guess he's a voice on CNN. He tweeted out his utter disdain for President Obama appearing on Between Two Ferns, which, as far as we can tell, was perhaps one of the most successful single day promotion of healthcare.gov that has ever existed. And frankly, even more importantly, from my perspective, it was funny. And there was a good piece, I think it was in Vulture, on an interview with Scott Aukerman, who's the director, and he does Comedy Bang Bang, and a dude I knew a little bit out in L.A. back in the day, and he was directed the piece with Zach Galifianakis. But these Gergen tweets about his uncomfortability with the whole thing are definitely worth reading. Am no fan of presidents appearing on shows like Between Two Ferns. Obama has better ways to reach out about, reach young about ACA. Well, A, no. I think the fact that so many people went to healthcare.gov referred from that video disproves the first part. And what other presidents ever had an opportunity to appear on a show like Between Two Ferns? I mean, I guess there could have been a YouTube show during the last term of the Bush administration, but presidents, really plural, there really hasn't been many presidents in office when there have been shows like this. Now, if he's talking about comedians, I mean, going on comedy shows, this has been happening for ages. For ages. And then, of course, Gergen tweeted, unimaginable that Truman, Ike, JFK, Reagan would appear on Between Two Ferns. Well, I gotta hand it to him. Yes, it is unimaginable. A, because the show didn't exist. B, the internet didn't exist. So there were no internet shows like that. I guess it's easier to imagine Reagan with, let's say, walking around with a monkey. You know what's really unimaginable is guys like, I guess, Lincoln or maybe Teddy Roosevelt appearing on TV. That just seems to me to be completely unimaginable. Can you imagine? And then he goes on to say they carefully protected the majesty of their office. It seems to me that actually presidents are not supposed to be majestic in that sense. I mean, I think there's something about the king and the founding of this country. I don't know. I have to check the Wikipedia on that. But then Gergen also wants to make it clear, I'm a big fan of Zach Galifianakis. He's hilarious, and his dad played high school football with my brother, Ken. Still, best venue for Obama, question mark? Unbelievable to see these guys freak out. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Marshall.
Oh,
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program senior fellow at the Regional Plan Association in New York and the author of the new book, The Surprising Design of Market Economies. Welcome to the program, Alex Marshall.
It's great to be here, Sam.
A lot of what you've written here, we've been talking about for some time, but it's the book is really a great sort of really laying out the relationship ultimately between markets and governments. Just start with this notion of a free market. You say that it's a dangerous euphemism. Why is that?
Well, it's a false concept, and so because it's false, it's misleading and leads you into places that aren't productive. What I say in the book is that government creates markets. The idea of buying and selling in any kind of organized way is something that's done through government, and without government, there can be no markets. That's a radical notion to some people, but it actually it becomes kind of obvious when you think about it. You can't own something without government basically saying to other people that you own it and creating something called property, and that's just the very basics. As you get more sort of organized, you have all sorts of things like corporations, which are a government creation, and patents, which are government creations, and then you get into things like roads and schools. And I mean, markets can be described like an onion. They look as if they are just there, but when you start stripping away the layers that governments create, there's nothing left if you take away the stuff that government makes. So what I argue in the book is that we should recognize that and then start having more productive conversations about, what kind of markets do we want? It's not really a question of regulating markets. It's a question of designing them or building them. And, things like corporations. Corporations aren't necessarily evil. They're just, they are a public creation that we should talk about what its rights and power should be and how we want to organize it.
Yeah, we will circle back to that notion of how to regulate. But let's what would on what basis we should make the determinations in which we do regulate. But let's start with in the book you take us through the sort of the development of the concept of property rights. Just walk us through some of that, because that is, I think, sort of is the fundamental building block, I think, of the creation of markets, right? I mean, you can't sell something that you don't
have
property rights.
It's basically kind of a conceptual evolution, the idea that you can own something. And so it went over centuries or millennium. It went through a series of stages that became more and more sort of developed, this idea of owning something. And that's particularly true with land. It's a bigger conceptual leap to say, I can own a piece of property. And so it evolved, and with government basically leading the way each step of the way, a big thing was basically just establishing systems of measurement. For land particularly, it's hard to make it into a market of something you can buy and sell if you can't measure it and you can't define it. And to do that, you need common systems of measurement. And so until about the 1800s, there weren't really any common systems of measurement. It was much more kind of vaguer. And so you had a sort of a series of evolutions of establishing that. And it's all very interesting history. I know that when we talked before the show that you liked the article I had in the magazine on the commons. I mean,
yes.
The book is really kind of optimistic in that it says if you look at history sort of more longer perspective, you see we sort of we seem to be working towards taking care of each other more, and despite a lot of bumps in the roads, the arc of history seems to be for us establishing more common systems, things like public water or public schools or even roads, firefighters. All these systems were, they didn't used to be here, and we have actually progressed that way. And none of these things came easily. Like something like public water, there was huge political battles about whether to have such a thing. And after like 50 years of fighting, a few cities did it, and then other ones followed because it was so successful. So. I'm essentially optimistic that we can sort of work of taking care of ourselves in better fashion.
Well, and I think you make a good case for that. But I think the concept of markets and the idea of the free market. I mean, particularly even on a day like today, where there's at least reports that the Obama administration, through the Labor Department, is going to essentially expand the number of people who are eligible for overtime work. And
yeah.
This is basically involves a regulation that the Labor Department puts out in terms of who, there are two different aspects of it, and we'll talk a little bit about it later in this program. But essentially, it's a regulatory change. We have a regulation that says certain people right now are eligible for overtime, and they're simply changing the parameters of that because the number of people eligible has sort of eroded over time. But this is sure to be we're going to hear particularly conservatives and libertarians say this is just an overreach where the government is getting involved in the marketplace where it doesn't belong. But in fact, even conceptually, that's just a bizarre statement to make.
Yeah. And on first blush, I'm a fan of what he's doing to make overtime apply to more people. I mean, the parameters of the market are all established by government. So if you want to say that you have to pay someone more for more than 40 hours a week or whatever, that's certainly fine. It's the same way it's fine to say, well, it's a crime to hit somebody on the head, or it's or that we have a particular kind of money. Or, I mean, there's nothing about the market that isn't defined or created by government. So what exactly those rules are is something we should be continually looking at. And it doesn't, the markets do not work by automatic pilot. That just doesn't work. I mean, we should aim towards simplicity and fairness, but there's no sort of magic system that can just be left alone and that works by itself. And the history clearly shows the opposite.
But let's talk a little bit about so-called intellectual property. This is one of those areas where you see that government has, in the course of shaping a market, has gone too far in creating monopolies. Talk about that.
Yeah, very, very much. So we've gone too far in handing out patents for everything under the sun, and giving people this basically a little government monopoly, for everything, for inventing a better pencil to a few lines of software code. And we've forgotten that that's what a patent is. A patent is a grant of government authority, and the word. It comes from the Latin literae patent, meaning an open letter from the king. The word used to be used more commonly for any kind of basically authority given out from the government. So it could be, you could get a patent. A patent could be a letter from the king authorizing you to have safe passage in a hostile land, or it could be a monopoly on selling salt because you were the king's brother. And the American Revolution was in part a reaction against the overuse of patents by the English government. They over the centuries they had been handed out for, you know, hundreds of different things, and when we say in our Constitution that they should only be for the advancement of science, I can't remember the exact words, but it's something like that. We've sort of forgotten the subtext of that, is that the founding fathers were saying, you know, we don't want these overused. We don't want these handed out indiscriminately, as was the case with Great Britain. So the patents are an important thing for the advancement of arts and science, but, you know, they... When they're too widespread, they actually impede the development of technology and science. And we've just gone too far with that. We need to basically remember that a patent is a politically and socially created tool that should only be used when it's basically benefiting us, the people who have put this system into place.
And you know, I want to get to that notion of the almost the argument of whom all of this that we're talking about should benefit. I mean, because that's really where the rubber meets the road. But let's talk about the existence of corporations and how that And you have an idea to change the charter of corporations. There was a report today that nearly $2 trillion is being kept offshore to avoid repatriation taxes. Talk about the development of the corporation that notion of how we can sort of fix corporations to function. In the benefit of more, I guess, Americans, really.
Yeah, who is a corporation for? I mean, the corporation has a long and very interesting history, and you know, it was originally done for, and still is, for things like cities and universities. You know, cities and universities are corporations, and the development of private corporations for private profit is a relatively new thing. You know, the corporation, something like IBM or General Motors, has come to symbolize the power of the private sphere. And so it's actually startling to most people if they're told or shown that the corporation, the vehicle, is created by government. You know, to be a corporation, you have to get a charter. And that charter has certain powers and responsibilities that are defined in it, and we can and should change that all the time. I think it helps people to understand what a corporation is. It's to understand that a city is a corporation. And as a professor, I like to quote, says, you know, we've forgotten that IBM and Albany are the same thing. So just as we can rewrite a city's charter, we can rewrite a company's charter, and what charters companies have in general. In the New York Times a year or two ago, I had an op-ed that advocating national charters for big companies. A big company like Apple Computers, they should have a national charter that defines their rights and responsibilities. We should end or bypass the system now that where basically a company can go to any state it likes and get a charter and then use it nationally and globally without basically any kind of common system. I mean, but what it leads to is kind of a race to the bottom, is that most companies go to Delaware, which has really, really easy incorporations, very few responsibilities, and then they kind of take that card and run with it. But there's nothing preventing Congress from establishing a National Companies Act that says all companies, say, above a certain size have to have, or that go do business across state lines, have to have a national charter. That's certainly what most other countries do. And, you know, so the company is a very big deal, but again, we hold the extension cord.
I mean, that's true, but there is something obviously that keeps Congress from doing that, right? I mean, that mm-hmm. is there's a tremendous amount
of money. Money and lobbying and all that. But, I mean, I don't know, every journey starts with a few steps, right? And I think the first steps are just realizing that we have that power. I think most people don't even realize that that's conceptually within Congress powers.
But isn't the, I mean, you know, once, I mean, because, you know, to a certain extent, you know, what we're talking about, I think for many of the people listening now, you know, sort of conceptually get this idea. I mean, it is this notion that markets are a construct of government. And anybody doing business, in fact, it came up in the election where President Obama said, you didn't build that, right?
Right.
And which, you know, if you carry that argument out, is that everything that happens in the marketplace, in any given market within our society, is a function of all sorts of different government regulations and public works. And in your book, you include in there everything from the police force to the library to obviously infrastructure and highways and an educated populace. All of this, these are public works, as well as the regulations, the contract enforcement, everything.
And you know, I wrote the book before President Obama, and then before her, you know, Elizabeth Warren made such headlines by saying that, but it perfectly encapsulated what I'm saying in the book. You know, you didn't make that. You know, it takes a government to make all this, and so I am happy that debate is beginning. Basically, for the Republican Party to basically base their entire convention around opposing that viewpoint, it shows in a way what an ideological battle that we're in. They obviously in some ways feel threatened by that. I don't think this has to be actually a liberal conservative divide. It's just a fact, basically, when you look at the foundations of markets, that they are instituted by government. So you should begin a conversation, well, what kind of foundations do we want?
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem with that ideological divide is mm-hmm. that it is a threat to mm-hmm. the interests of those who dominate our government through money and use government as a mechanism in which to enrich themselves further. I mean, you know, patents mm-hmm. is an example of that, but we can see it across the board. And in that piece about the commons, that it has expanded, not shrunk, over the past 200 years, on some level, are we not seeing a regression? Let me start with this. Define for us what the commons are and take us through that argument that they have expanded a little further, because then I think some of the examples
The commons are the things we do in common, and certainly historically the definition of the commons or you could just call it infrastructure has changed to be more inclusive. People didn't used to think of water as something that would be done publicly. They didn't used to think of trash collection or police force. Police forces are actually relatively new, or most importantly, educating your children. That was not thought of as something to be handled collectively. Now it's pretty much accepted, all those things, even if we debate about the particulars. So the arc of history is tending that way, and I think the current healthcare debate is about that. You know, there are a lot of us saying healthcare is something that just makes sense to handle more collectively, it doesn't mean that you have to socialize all the economy, but for healthcare, that makes some sense. You know, are we stepping backwards at times? Yes, and that certainly does happen.
The commons also a reflection of rights that we all have to certain goods or services, right? I mean that. I mean, so that it's the water in the river, for instance, mm-hmm. or yep. The
yeah,
air that we breathe.
Air, yeah, there's, yes.
And there's, then we're adding, as we go, we are adding, at least in certain contexts, other rights. You know, if you live in a city, for instance, you have mm-hmm. a right to drinking water that comes out yep. of your tap, ostensibly.
Right.
Right. You don't necessarily have that right if you live in a rural area. And, you know, we see things like, you know, in West Virginia, for instance, you know, that is an infringement upon our rights to poison the water supply yeah. and the natural resources. And so your argument is that we are at the beginning of seeing healthcare as a right.
Right. As a collective responsibility. And that we are talking about how to protect the environment is actually, in a way, helps advance my thesis, you know, because, you know, 100 years ago, that probably wasn't seen so much. But now I think we do generally see most of us see protecting the water and the air as a collective responsibility, again, even if we argue about the means. You know, it's funny, I happen to be reading, just starting that book that got a lot of publicity, called The Angels of Our Better Nature by Steven Pinker, I think it is. But he argues basically that we are getting less violent, and that even though a lot of horrible things happen today and around the world, we're actually kind of kill fewer people and hurt people less than we used to. It's funny because I realize I'm kind of saying the same thing, except on a different subject, that we are taking care of each other better. So it's an optimistic portrayal, basically. I think we can progress. I mean, it is a real problem, though, that the Anglo-Saxon system of government we have here in America is basically designed to prevent change. So it is more difficult here than in other countries, particularly, so something like healthcare, it's not just that we're basically careless about our fellow man, that we don't have healthcare, national healthcare, and basically every other country does. It's because our system of government is uniquely designed to prevent change. And that has given us a valuable stability over the centuries, but it's also given us a something that has a lot of ill effects, basically. It's why it took us so long to have a bunch of changes that were ultimately beneficial. So we have to work with that.
I'm not as, optimistic about, I mean, because maybe it's because I have arguments seemingly on a daily basis as to the idea that we all own the water. As to the idea that healthcare is a right, or that we should actually have empathy for other people who are ill. I mean, you know, you can look to, you know, I think undergirding the reason why you have nearly 20 states in this country that would not expand Medicaid or more, mm-hmm. I think, is that notion of that it's just not our responsibility fundamentally, right? I mean, the question isn't how.
Yeah, that's what
it's
they're saying. The states that are not expanding Medicare, it's incredibly callous and cruel. I mean, I'm amazed that states are taking that tack, some of them, but yet, you know, we actually are further along than we were, you know, 6 years ago. And if you look historically, what those states are saying is very similar to what some states said 200 years ago when they were refusing to have public education. You know, people said quite loudly, you know, legislators stood up and said, you know, it's not my responsibility to educate my neighbor's child. You know, why should I have to pay for that? And it took many decades before every state in the union had public education. Right, basically, Pennsylvania was the first to have public education. Common schools, they were called. It was in 1830-something. And it was into the 20th century before every state had both public education and mandatory education for children. So it's a long process.
What do you think? I mean, when we see things like when we see things like this sort of reform, so-called reform movement of education, which in many respects is as much about privatization as it is anything else, in my estimation. I mean,
I think we have to some extent, get some of the emotions out of it, because with education right now, I believe that we're mostly arguing about tactics, not rights. I think those on both sides of the sort of aisle or debate accept that the government should pay to educate children. So when you get into the questions like, well, should we have charter schools or not, or vouchers, or public education, I think it is actually one where there are good people on both sides, and we're actually confused on it. You know, we're groping our way forward as to what is the best way to do this. It's certainly here in New York City a very big debate. The new mayor, Bill de Blasio, has taken money away from charters. Mayor Bloomberg was a big fan of them. Are both men good men? I think they are. Personally, I side more with de Blasio. I have a child in public schools, and you know, it doesn't seem right to me to give a charter school sort of free housing in a public school and various other special rights. And I am a fan more of general public education, but it doesn't mean that those who support charters are literally just trying to kind of steal public education. I don't think that's the case.
So, I don't think the argument has to be about there are good or bad people involved in this, but I do think that at the end of the day, it does implicate the notion of whether or not this is a common, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Because implied in the notion of something being a common means that we collectively have oversight of it, and that we
and
specifically charters, there is none of that. It is a transfer of money, yes, but it is not, does not involve the other half of that equation, which is that we ensure that, okay, it's one thing to say, you know, the public's going to pay for water to be in people's homes, but in some people's homes, it may come out at one drip at a time. Other people are going to get it to actually flow. I mean, that implicates, right, as to whether or not that is actually a right, and whether or not, not just that we should collectively deliver it, but whether or not we have a right to get it, therefore it must be collectively delivered.
Yeah. I mean, we are debating about what the commons should be. And you know, when we come to schools, we come to, well, what should you teach? As I say in the book, I'm a big fan of a common culture, and that should be taught, which is usually often a more conservative notion. But I think a lot of liberals and progressives have gone astray there, that where we highlight or idealize multiculturalism and really don't understand that having a common culture is actually a very important thing in a country and in a market. It's actually, I'm a fan of E.D. Hirsch, who popularized a lot of this, but he considered himself a great liberal. But to have a common language and a common history that you taught, it's a more democratic society and a more mobile society economically. Unless you sort of spend political capital in creating a common language, common culture, then you risk kind of fragmenting your society, which is ultimately a less mobile society economically. So all these debates get into schools. You know, should charter schools each be teaching their own little thing? Should we have a common curriculum?
Well, but I'm not even saying, I'm not even talking about the curriculum, because I think that is, that's an argument that takes place once you determine that everyone has the same rights to an education. Then you have a subsidiary conversation as to what that education should consist of. But the issue, it seems to me, with charters, and I'm just using that as an example because it's here, is that you are wresting control away from the entity that we have all sort of subscribed to, government, to say things like, you have to accept all kids who come in, or that this can't be a self-selecting process, or
I agree. I'm not a fan of charter schools. So I basically agree with you. I mean, I think you're right. I don't know about all, but a lot of charter schools have very dangerous things. Things like being able to simply refuse kids that public schools don't have. It shouldn't be right that your regular public school has to accept all kids with disabilities or whatever, while the charter schools get to pick and choose. There are some dangerous things with the charter school concept, but so I agree with you there.
And lastly, let me just ask you about this notion of scarcity. When we talk about having access to clean drinking water and whatnot, there's scarcity may end up beginning to define sort of our existence as we go forward. And how does that impact the notion of the commons?
The scarcity of something like water?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think it can be managed successfully. It's New York City certainly has a record of that. We are about to build some billion-dollar water treatment plants about 15 years ago, and we instituted this whole series of conservation in upstate New York for conservation measures within the society. And basically, the water system is in pretty good shape now. So I think these problems are sort of actionable. I want to get a plug, though, for something that just occurred to me I think progressives, we need to paint an optimistic picture if we want to advance change. And so I think there are possibilities for that. And one area which I think really has potential is public broadband networks or public fiber optic networks. It's really kind of the battleground of the future. And I think there's a lot of potential for cities and municipalities basically laying their own fiber optic systems and then giving their people access to broadband and actually telephone, cable television, managing electricity. It has enormous potential. And what's interesting is that it's actually a replay of the fight that occurred in the 1930s over public power. Franklin Roosevelt was a huge advocate for public power. And because of that, we got actually a lot of cities with public power, but also we got the rural electric cooperatives, which have all worked really very well. And the public utility cities range from very small towns in North Carolina to Los Angeles, which has public power. So as we go into the digital future, those cities that can manage to build their own public fiber optic networks will be in much better shape. There's several hundred towns and cities have done it, and the big cable companies like Comcast are fighting that tooth and nail. It has not received as much publicity as it should, but I think that's a productive battleground for the future.
Alex Marshall, from your mouth to the Department of Justice Antitrust Division's ears,
and
the FCC for that matter. The book is The Surprising Design of Market Economies. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Alex Marshall, thanks so much for your time today.
It's been great to be here, and it's nice being on the show. Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to head into our fun half of the program, wherein we will... I will get to that piece where Mike Huckabee is telling the ladies, telling his fellow Republicans how to run against ladies. And we also have, the expansion of overtime. That's fun. And it's going to be super fun to watch the incredible freakout that is going to take place over something that, when it's happened in the opposite direction, of course, was simply... de rigueur, as we say, in my learning annex French class that I'm not really taking. Folks, if you want to support this program and send me to a real learning French annex class, become a member today at majority.fm. Pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen. Pennies a day. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap, if you buy crap from Amazon, through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, always use it to buy your Amazon crap. We get a kickback JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code majority, get 10% off. Want to be a part of the program? Want to complain about how we were laughing yesterday at the fact that Republican lawmakers were complaining that President Obama was doing a Between Two Ferns show when nothing's happened with Benghazi? If you want to call in and complain that we were laughing about that, by all means, 646-257-3920. In fact, we're going to open up a separate line for you. It'll be 646-257-3920.
Definitely, if you interpreted that as us laughing at four people dying in Benghazi, please call.
Yes.
We need your insight.
It's exactly the same between, and here you go. And here's like a screenshot from Bill O'Reilly. His talking points for the day, using comedy to promote Obamacare. Abe Lincoln would not have done it. I couldn't agree more.
That's a really solid point.
The real question is, would Lincoln have supported Lincoln Care that way?
I could actually picture a lot of these presidents insulting Zach Galifianakis in that format.
That's right.
So, I mean, you know, to be fair here, like I could definitely Truman. Truman seemed like he could.
Truman would. I think Lincoln would.
Lincoln had a great sense of humor.
I mean, Lincoln was a big fan of comedy.
Lincoln was a master joke teller.
Wasn't he watching a comedy when he was shot?
I don't know if that was a comedy.
It was a comedy in theater.
I'm pretty sure.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but maybe.
Did you just get that from the same place that the people were making?
That's what Bill O'Reilly said. All right, we got to take a break. You can IM us at Majority FM. You can call us at 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment. Mark Mazzetti on the program tomorrow.